This podcast is a production of The Orchard, a church community located in Aurora, Illinois, whose mission is leading people into a growing relationship with Jesus Christ. Visit us online at orchardvalleyonline.com.
Thank you. It's great to be here. The Orchard, I love it. Last time I was here was a year ago, and my, what a difference a year makes. Got a Saturday service, you guys are growing, and got the big baptism and barbecue next week. Exciting stuff. I love coming here. Thank you for having me. And when Scott talked to me about coming, and he said, hey, we're doing a movie theme this time, I thought, that's great. And because I love the movies. And in fact, my book, Experiential Storytelling, talks about how movies are they're the storytellers of this generation. And so there's something really powerful about a movie. And so this morning, I've picked the movie Pee-wee's Big Adventure. No, I'm kidding. I did not do that. The guys in the back are like, oh no, we got to change the clips. No, actually, I did not. I chose a movie that's a little bit weightier than that. In fact, it's the movie called The Great Debaters. How many of you have seen The Great Debaters? Okay, three of you. All right, the rest of you, go out today and rent it. It really is. It's a powerful movie. You're going to see some scenes today that I think are going to be a little bit unsettling to you, and I think that's intentional, because really the movie is one of those that just, it grips your heart. And it's a true story, actually, and it's set in the 1930s about racial prejudice in the deep South. And in the first clip, what you see is these great debaters. They're at an all-black college. They are, for the first time, having the opportunity to debate an all-white school in Oklahoma. And we'll see what happens here in just a minute. This is towards the end of the debate. Yeah, don't you want to do that? Don't you just want to be like, yes, woo! And it's so powerful. I'm like, okay, we're done. Let's go home. The time for justice is always, always now. And I love the contrast, too, between the songs and that line, because the song that they played was a John Mayer song. And by the way, if you could just put aside some of the political stuff, I know that there were some political, you know, jabs in the song. But the real message of the song is, we're waiting on the world to change. Waiting on the world to change. He even repeats it, waiting on the world to change, as if it's just going to be like, what are we waiting for? We're just waiting. And what a contrast to this statement, someone who in the 1930s has obviously experienced a lot of injustice, and she's saying the time for justice is always, always now. Well, growing up in suburban Cincinnati, I can't say that I encountered a lot of what I would say in-your-face blatant injustice. And I was growing up in a, you know, it was a nice middle-class neighborhood, and I would hear stories about how God, he's the God of justice. I would hear how God is a defender of the fatherless and a champion for the poor and the oppressed. And, you know, I had a difficult time connecting with this message because I really hadn't seen a whole lot of that. Little did I know that injustice, poverty, and deliverance would come calling to me. See, my wife and I, we pretty much had our lives planned out. How many of you have done that? Planned out. All right, here's what it is. We're going to graduate from college, get a nice job, get a nice minivan. I don't know if that was part of the dream, but something like that. We talked about having kids. We'll have 2.5 children, you know, because my wife wanted three and I wanted two, and so we had to work on that a bit. You know, the picket fence. You know the story. It's the American dream that's sold to us and packaged to us. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but that was our idea. We had expectations, and that's just how it works, right? Well, things were going pretty much as planned. We both graduated. I got a job at a large church, and I remember when they told me how much I was going to be making, it was a little over $20,000. We looked at each other and we're like, how are we ever going to spend this much money? There's no way. In fact, I thought Lifestyles and the Rich and Famous, they were going to start calling us, and you know, they were going to do cribs, and they were going to come into our apartment and show us all the stuff we had. It's amazing what a few decades and a few more children can do. But that was the dream, and we felt like we were living it. And in fact, it's like, all right, well, let's start a family. Well, let's do it. So the first month we tried to get pregnant. What happens? We did. I'm like, life is good. I was the life is good t-shirt. You know, that was our life. How many of you get the sense that this story is about to change? Yeah, you would be correct. See, life was pretty easy for us until we tried to get pregnant a second time. And there were other issues that we faced along the way, but this one really hit at the root of our expectations. It also hit it a little bit at the root of our control, and more importantly, it touched us at a level because we really felt like this is what we were supposed to do, is have a bigger family, right? And so we tried, and after that first year, we were like, well, this is kind of weird. We can't get pregnant. That's weird. And then year three and year four, year five, year six, and year seven. And we discovered what is called secondary infertility. That the first time you can get pregnant, everything's great, and then you just can't get pregnant again. And it was painful. And I know some of you can identify with that kind of pain even today. But our thought was, God, where are you? And did you forget our checklist? Things were going so well, you know? It's like the plans. Maybe he'd forgotten us too. And what made it even more difficult is I'm a pastor at the time. So here I am trying to minister to people. At the same time, I'm dealing with these issues and these conflicting. And I'm like, God, what are you doing? But what we hadn't realized is that God not only was going to answer our prayers to expand our family, but in his own, only God can do this way, he was going to do it in such a way that he would introduce this earthly father to the heartbeat of the heavenly father. And how he did this is he did this through some miraculous circumstances, it really is, that brought us to adopt a baby girl from Vietnam. And at the time, it was just an amazing experience. Adoption is, it's just an incredible experience. But I remember when I was taking the first trip, because back in the day, there was two trips that you had to take. You had to take one, the first trip, and then you do all your paperwork, and then you come back a second time. Well, we couldn't afford to both go, so I had to go by myself. So I remember that first trip, you know, you're driving in the, you know, it's, I mean, driving, driving in the water over the ocean, no, flying over the ocean. And you know, you're treated pretty well. You're watching your movies. You go to the hotel, and even there, they have some Western-style hotels there that are quite nice for about $80 a night. So it was great. And I was like, wow, this is great. We're going to go see our baby and everything. What I hadn't anticipated was the cultural disconnect of what I was about to experience. As I left my hotel, and I drove in this van with our interpreter and a few other families that were adopting, and we made a right-hand turn down this little street that was just sand. And there were a bunch of goats in the road, and so the goats had to part. And I was like, wow. And then we stopped in front of the orphanage, and here's a picture of it. And that's the gate that we walked through, and our interpreter said, and there, right behind there, you can't really see it very well, but right behind there he said, that's the orphanage. And it was a room of about 500 square feet, maybe, home to 20 of the most beautiful children that you can imagine. But they were crammed in there. And this day, what I really remembered about it, and I can still remember it even now, is the smell. Because there was the smell in that orphanage was a combination of formula and dirty bottles and dirty diapers, and outside the back of the orphanage there were these lines, and there were the diapers that they would use. They would use like bandanas, you know, that you use for your head. That's what they'd use, and they'd just tie them, and that was it. And so they had washed them, and they were doing the best job that they could. And I knew that the caregivers, that they loved the kids, but the conditions were pretty rough. And I just remember thinking, wow, I've never really experienced something like this firsthand. And then I was handed my baby, who was a little dirty. She smelled just like the orphanage. And I remember when they handed her over to me, and I said, what is her name? And they said, her name is Hoai. See, in Vietnam, they have the names for children. They're kind of like word pictures. You know, like here in America, it's like, well, what does Tom mean? Well, Tom means Tom. You know, it's like, wow, that is so deep. But it's a culture critique there. Sorry about that. But then you go to Vietnam, and there's like this. When he said the name Hoai, I knew immediately to ask, what does Hoai mean? I asked the interpreter, and he thought, well, how do I say this in English? He's thinking for a minute. Then he looks me in the eyes, and he says, it means worth remembering. And something happened to my heart in that moment. Well, that was 2003, and since then, we've adopted another baby girl from the same orphanage, which was a pretty incredible thing as well, and here's a picture of them. They're with us today. This is my Ramsey, and yes, we did retain her name. It's Ramsey Jewel Hoai Miller. She's on the right, and this is Rowan Grace Lynn Miller, and Lynn was her Vietnamese name, and that means a beautiful flower, and so there are flowers that are worth remembering, is what our children are. But when I was there, in one short moment of time, my world forever changed. My eyes were open to a world that I had never seen before. My heart was now open to feel things that I had never felt before. And as I delve deeper into issues of poverty and human rights abuses that came out of this, because there's so much going on to this day, not just in Vietnam, but the entire Asian region, such as the sex slave trafficking that happens even now, my eyes were open. But what happened was, through the pain of infertility, God broke our hearts, and he gave us the gift of knowing his. He opened our eyes to a world that is full of suffering and oppression, a world that is not just. Injustice for us now had a name and it had a face. And for this dad, injustice got real personal. You know, in the years since, I'm continually reminded by God that all who are hurting, all who are oppressed, all of those who face injustice, all of those who are fatherless, that all of them are worth remembering. And when I smell something that's not the greatest smell in the world, it reminds me again that God came into this world and he got his hands dirty. In fact, he came to some of the most dirty, most forgotten places to find us in our filth, to reconcile us with him. That's our God that we serve. But you know, at some time in our life, all of us have seen injustice. It might be a movie, or maybe it was firsthand, or maybe you've just seen oppression in some form or another. But we're also bombarded by images, especially in news. I mean, you think about it, you know, 10, 15 years ago, we didn't have 24-hour news channels. Now we got them all. We've got news that are bombarding us with these images that something is not right with this world. And it's not just cable. It's not just the internet. You can get it on your phone right now. In fact, some of you probably are right now, like, hey, getting the news. But the updates that we get all remind us that something is not quite right with this world. And what happens is you hear this stuff, and you hear all these stats, and you hear all of these things that are happening around the world. And if you're like me, you kind of just get numb to it all. All of these stats and all of these things that are happening almost become like wallpaper. You know, remember wallpaper? Some of you are like, hey, I still have it. I say, good for you. Because it's coming back, is what I hear. But it's like wallpaper, you know, you don't know it's there, and yet it's there. There's a pattern there, but you don't even think about it. And so it's just wallpaper on your computer screen. It's just there and you forget that it's there. Do you remember the Iraq War in the very beginning when it first started and there were like 20 casualties or even 5 casualties and it was like, oh man, our troops are dying, and it was front page news and we were praying and we were tying ribbons around and all of these things. And then years later, now we've got what's called war fatigue, is what they call it. And I'll tell you, the families that have lost loved ones yesterday in the Iraq War, they don't have war fatigue. They've got war sorrow. But what do we have? We've got war fatigue because we've seen it so much that it's almost lost its meaning. And so instead of being front and center for us being able to read this, it now doesn't even make it on the front page of the paper or even in the front section. See, that's what happens. The real world issues become like wallpaper, and we don't even recognize that there's a name and a face to each one of these issues. Stats like these, like there are 143 million orphans worldwide, 143 million children needing a home. Or stats like two-thirds of the world population lives on less than $2 a day. You know, when we were in Vietnam, there was this one day in particular where there were just kids everywhere, and we were like, "What's going on?" And they were saying, "Well, this is National Teacher Day, so they give the kids the day off." I think they should give the teachers the day off, and then the kids could still have to go to school. But they didn't. But the teachers actually had the day off, and I went into this one shop. It was a silk shop. And this woman was, there were all these girls gathered around her. And I said, "What's going on over there?" They said, "Well, this is teacher day, and that's a teacher." I'm like, "Well, she has a day off. What's she doing?" "Well, she's teaching these girls how to sew so that they can actually have a meaningful wage someday." I said, "Are you serious?" I said, "I applaud that teacher." And I was like, "I want to give her something, but what can I give her?" And so I reached in my pocket, And I pulled out a dollar bill, and I said, "You know," I asked the interpreter, "can I give her this?" And he said, "Yeah." He was like, "Go ahead." And so I walked down, and I said, "I want to give you something." So I handed it to her, and she took it. It's okay. It's Scott's. So you can keep it. But I handed it to her, and I just remember she was like, "Oh, no, 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 no." And I was like, "Yeah." I was like, "And tell her that I'm glad that she's a teacher. That's something that's a great, great job, and she's still teaching the students. I wanted to do something for her." So he told her all that, and then when the girls around her heard what was happening and she took the dollar bill, they all just started clapping and jumping up and down. They were like, "Yeah," they were all celebrating. I mean, it was like I was at a rock concert. They were that excited. And I didn't realize at that time that in Vietnam, the average wage was a dollar. And so this $1 that I just happened to have spare change that I was probably was a taxi ride somewhere or in Vietnam, things are pretty cheap, but that $1 for her was a day's wage. See, that experience did something to me. And again, left a mark on me. It was more than a stat, it was now a face. Stats like the number one killer in Africa is polluted water. Every year, 10 million children die before their fifth birthday, nearly all of them from what Bono calls stupid poverty. You know, you can feel overwhelmed by all of this stuff. And you can also feel a little cynical. In fact, both of those messages were in that song, "Waiting on the World to Change," because it kind of causes inaction. Because it's like, man, what do we do? There's one side I'm seeing all these stats, and the other side I'm kind of cynical. I see all this stuff happening, but then I also hear, in fact, my wife and I were talking about it this last week, how the Green Bay Packers are going to pay Brett Favre $20 million to stay home and stay retired and work on the farm. How many of you would love $20 million to retire? Yeah. In fact, I heard the board here is considering that for Scott. No, I'm kidding. Just kidding. But I mean, think about that. If you're giving your star quarterback, "I'm going to give you money to stay home," you can get a little cynical about the world when you hear stuff like that, can't you? The world isn't fair, and it can feel frustrating. The world isn't just, and what difference can we make? You know, I think our hearts want to do something, but again, we feel a little bit helpless. That's why I love this clip in the movie so much, because here we peer backwards to a day not even 100 years ago. In fact, my dad was born in the 1930s, which is the setting for this film. A time when Jim Crow laws were still in effect, where the South still had separate toilets, is what we're talking about, and lynchings still occurred. And in this clip, Samantha's doing something unheard of because the all-black school was now debating an all-white school, and she says that the time for justice is not next week, not next month, but the time for justice is always, always now. Why is that? Because injustice never takes a holiday. But what is justice? I mean, if we think about it, because really, that's a pretty large term too. In fact, I heard somebody say, you know, if you think about justice is a whole lot easier to demand than to define, because it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But for me, I simply see justice as righting wrongs. You know, all of us have this sense that, you know what, there's something wrong in this world. There's oppression. There's people that are being weighed down. There's poverty. There's orphans. There's these things that just are not quite right. And so to put those things right, that is a part of justice, is saying, I want to take some of these wrongs and I want to simply right some of these wrongs. And then you've got the idea that's a little bit further for people who truly do want to grow in a relationship with Jesus Christ. Now we have biblical justice, which takes it even a step forward in that we now have the opportunity to join God in his restorative mission to right the wrongs of this world. You know, a few weeks ago, how many of you were here for Jeff Schinnebarger? Great talk. And he talked about this, the grand story that all of us share. In fact, if you look at the fall, our creation, fall, redemption, and restoration, I've done a little bit of writing and talking about storytelling. And the reason why a story usually has a beginning and there's kind of something nice, and then all of a sudden you have the tension, and then what happens is the tension's resolved, and then you finally walk out, and usually with Hollywood there's a happy ending. What is that about? That's because, why does that resonate with everybody, every single human being? That's because that story is imprinted on our hearts, because it's the story of humanity. It's God's story. It's our story. And the thing about it is, there's creation, there's fall, there's redemption, and then there's restoration. And I will tell you, I believe that we are living in the restoration age. We're living in an age of restoration. And you know, if we're wanting to be a part of growing in Jesus Christ, then we will be a part of his restorative work. See, this is God's heartbeat, and part of our missional response to him is repairing the self-inflicted damage of the fall. So anywhere there's a disconnect from God's original creative plan between us and God, between us and the environment, us and each other, then there is now a need for restoration, whether that is polluting the environment or people who can't afford to eat or orphan care or helping those who are suffering. And if we open our eyes, we can begin to see that injustice, or maybe should we say justice opportunities, are all around us. Restorative opportunities. And why is it important? I love Dr. Martin Luther King's famous quote. He says it's important because injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. So when we see that and we do nothing and we wait for the world to change, we're letting that injustice continue, and it will spread. But God tells us that the time for justice is now. In fact, the Bible reveals to us from beginning to end a God who is passionate about justice. In fact, numerous times in the Bible, God declares, I am the God who loves justice. It literally says that. I am the God who loves justice. Not the God who likes it. Not the God who tolerates it. Not the God who says, you know what, it would really be a nice program in your church. No, I am the God who loves justice. And if we're going to grow in our relationship with him, then we're going to want to love the things that he loves as well. We're going to want to embrace those things that he embraces. And you know, I think part of the problem is we have a misconception when we talk about God and then we talk about justice. Because a lot of times what we think about is God and justice is we think of it simply as punishment. That God is this angry old man up there and he's like, all right, it's time for justice. You know, time to go to the woodshed. How many of you remember the woodshed? Oh, my. Yeah, and it's like, it's time for that. And so God's just like, take your spankings. Or God's like this. Or some people feel like God's like, you know what? You made a mess of things. Go deal with it yourself. Good luck. So God leaves us to do our own stuff. Not only are these views simply inaccurate, but both of them lose out on the best part of what we see in God's word, and that is this, that God actually invites us. He's given us a standing invitation as beings created in his holy image to participate in his restorative work to right the wrongs in our world. As creations in his image, we reflect now God's justice through our actions. See, for God, the time for justice is always now because God is a God of justice. Listen to these verses. Isaiah 1:17, seek justice, rescue the oppressed, defend the orphan, plead for the widow. Or James 1:27, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this, to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. You know, when we read, and by the way, I could have gone on for a long time with verse after verse after verse. Just read Jesus' mission statement in Luke 4 or Isaiah 61 or Isaiah 58 and how he ties it back into there. And just tell me how passionate even Jesus is for his church and his people to be part of this mission in justice. But the issue is, where do we start? If you're like me, you're probably feeling a little weighty right now. Because when I hear of these things or I hear a message like this, I'm like, oh, it's just heavy. Or again, we hear all those stats and they're just ringing and you're like, oh, you know, it's just overwhelming. You know, we're not superheroes. In fact, although if you look at the movies nowadays, you'd think that all of us want to be superheroes because there's superheroes everywhere. You know, I wonder if the amount of news that we're getting, because it's been inundating us with technology speeding up so fast that over the last 5 years, because we're bombarded by more and more news of injustice and bad stuff, I wonder if that's why Hollywood keeps giving us more and more superheroes. Because isn't it a great idea? It's like, man, the world is screwed up and we need somebody who's going to do something about it. So what do? We flip the switch and we put the bat signal up, or the spidey senses are tingling or whatever that is. And suddenly I've got to do something about this. And the superhero goes into action. And what does everybody do on the sideline? Woo! You the man, you know? And it feels like that's kind of what we want. We want something like that to rescue. We want a superhero to come along. Well, really, the cool thing about the Bible is that all the great heroes that we read about are actually people who you wouldn't think of as a superhero. In fact, so many of them were just common people like you and me. In fact, a lot of the heroes are a little bit more like Frodo in The Lord of the Rings, that short little hobbit who was asked to do this great task, than the superheroes that we see in Hollywood. And so he uses the least likely. And I think there's a few things that we can do to help us to get started. But before we start, I want you to watch one more clip. It's slightly longer. And just ask God to do something on your heart while you watch this. That's painful to watch, isn't it? And depending on your own personal story, you may identify with different pieces of that. Some of you may identify with the person who's the person that's had the injustice done unto them. Or maybe some of you are I just remember watching the boy, and I've seen that clip several times, but I just see him watching his dad, watching or peering into this injustice that happens and feeling helpless, like, I want to do something. I think that's why I didn't get back in the car. Some of us identify with the oppressor. We've done some things, or we've done some things in our lives that have been oppressive, or we've actually been a part of injustice. Whatever your viewpoint, it's unsettling when we see something like that. Scenes like this, they touch us deeply. They also erase our awareness, not just to injustice that happened in our history, but they also help us to identify with people. They help us to identify with the sufferings of others. And I would say, you know, by reading or even watching a movie or a biography, or better yet, even going to a place where suffering occurs, we can actually begin to develop what is called compassion permanence. It's a great term by Gary Haugen. It's in your notes there. But I think this is a starting place. Because really, starting to right the wrongs that are around us really begins with a heart of compassion. And part of the issue for most of us is that we have some experience that stirs compassion in us. But like an infant, where you remove an object from in front of them, you know how infants just all of a sudden forgot that that object was even there? We need to develop not that infant mentality of forgetfulness, but we need to develop in us compassion permanence that will help us to remember something, a scene, an experience, or something. Because I believe that when something moves your heart with compassion, I believe that that is God's way of getting your attention. I believe it's God's way of saying, I want you to partner with me because I am a God who loves justice. I am a God of justice. I want you to be part of righting wrongs. And so when some wrong touches your heart, what do you do? Because a lot of times I've seen some of the most, I've witnessed something, it's been on, a TV show or something or whatever, or it's the Iraq War or whatever, and then all of a sudden I go to, man, I wonder what the Cubs did today. Or, you know, man, those gas prices stink. And suddenly that's injustice to me, you know. Isn't it amazing how many distractions we can have? In fact, after the first service, I was talking to a woman that said, thank you for that compassion permanence piece because I just got back from Uganda and it's so easy to forget the suffering that is going on there. I need something to help me that will develop compassion permanence. See, the compassion is something that Jesus was moved with. In fact, it says he was moved with compassion, which means he could not stop himself from going to where those places of suffering were. He couldn't stop himself like a magnet and a piece of metal to the leper colonies or the outcasts or the suffering that was around. And I believe that sometimes we need to use our empathic imagination, which is simply a way of saying, put yourself in the shoes of somebody else. Because when I've seen that clip, I've thought, man, what would it be like? What would I want to do? First of all, I'd argue, hey, it was an accident, buddy, you know, first of all. But you don't do that in the mid-30s in Texas. Tough scene to see. But I put myself in that place and I say, what would I do? What did that make me feel like? Jesus was the greatest empathic person that there was. Because, in fact, Philippians 2, 5 through 8 tells us, it talks about all of us to say, hey, your attitude should be the same as Jesus Christ, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and even became obedient to death, even death on a cross. See, Jesus suffers the worst injustice of all by taking on all of the injustice of the world on the cross through his death. And at that one moment, and it is the symbol of our faith, at that one moment, he not only was remembering the suffering of the world, but he was dying to do something about it. Jesus knows that the time for justice is always, always now. Let's watch that third and final clip.
Die.
Great scene. Great scene. And how many at the beginning couldn't understand because they had their cork in their mouth? That's how Scott and I actually prepare for sermons. Great words, though. If you didn't get it, who is the judge? The judge is God. Why is he God? Because he decides who wins or loses. Who is your opponent? He does not exist. Why does he not exist? Because he is a mere dissenting voice of the truth I speak. Speak the truth. You know, there's a lot to this clip, but I love that last line. Speak the truth. Because joining God in his restorative work means that we will have to develop courage. It was courage for them as they, the next scene here is they stand before Harvard and they're actually debating. Again, true story. It took courage for them to do that, to speak the truth. And see, when we step out in courage, other people are inspired. Others are encouraged. In fact, that's the next thing. I think we need to develop contagious courage. Because the Bible's full of stories about courageous people who take a stand. One story in particular is in Acts, where Paul was simply trying to share with people the love of Jesus. And what happens? He's beaten and he's left for dead. And then the next verse, 21, it says that he left town. And then the very next verse says he comes back to the town, which I love. And why does he come back? It says that he comes back to encourage the followers of Jesus there. See, being a part of God's missional justice means at times we're going to have to speak the truth in love. It means at times we're going to have to step out in courage and step outside of our comfort zone. It means that sometimes we're going to have to face fear head on. And if we do that, sometimes we're going to feel a little alone and we're going to feel like we need a little bit of courage. But God calls us to his mission, and it is God who gives us the courage to follow through. That's why it doesn't matter about the opponent, because God is for us in his restorative mission. And he also gives us each other to speak courage into one another. Isn't it a whole lot easier to have courage when you're with somebody else? I know that I have this happen every single night. This is on display for me because I have a 5-year-old and I have a 2-year-old, and something happens between the ages of 2 and 3, and they just don't like the dark anymore. And so I don't know what happens, but you put one of them in a room and it's like, I'm alone, I'm isolated, what am I? But you put two of them together and somehow they can handle the darkness. And I was reading the book of Acts recently, and I was looking at that word courage throughout, and I noticed the word encourage has the word courage in it. And I thought about that, and there's also the word discourage as well. See, the prefix encourage, en means this. The prefix en means to put into. The prefix dis means to take away from. So when Paul was encouraging these followers of Christ, what was he doing? He was actually speaking courage into them, into their lives. And I think, and that's the question, is are we encouragers or are we discouragers? You've been around encouragers. Encouragers are somebody that make you feel like, you know what, I can do this. They just helped me. They spoke courage into me. Discouragers are like deflating a balloon when they enter the room. See, we need a church that is full of encouragers, especially when we hear that God is calling someone to do something that's bigger than themselves, or when God is moving on someone's heart with compassion. We need to have the courage to be able to say, what is God doing in you? And talk about that. And let's talk about what we can do, maybe to make a difference. And finally, we also need to develop creative action. Genesis 1, 2, and 3 tells us that the earth was formless and the Spirit of God was hovering over all of it. Then God begins his creative explosion. Let there be light. And he's creating. It's the greatest act of creation because it is creation. Everything else is recreation. And being involved in God's restorative justice, bringing things back to that place where God wants it to be, that is a piece of God, and his Spirit will give us the creative ability to come up with solutions to be able to right the wrongs that are around us. See, God doesn't leave us. He doesn't say, hey, good luck. Figure out all the problems. No, what God does is he gives us people. He gives us the church. And Orchard, I want to tell you, when I come here, I love it because you guys are a creative people. I just see it in everything you do, and I see it in the lives of people around. And I want to encourage you to use that creative capital when God moves on your heart with compassion to begin to step out and to be able to right some of these wrongs. You know, the great debaters, they use their words as creative weapons to fight. And I love Jeff Schinnebarger's idea about using balance on gift cards. See, that's a creative solution to be able to say, you know what, there's some stuff going on that we can do something about. We did something recently called Cell Phones for Soldiers, and there's places now that you can bring your cell phones in. You bring them into to refurbish them and to recycle them, so it's helping the environment, and then they give phone cards to soldiers that are overseas. See, I love those ideas. We need to be a part of that. I want to encourage you. I want to encourage you as a church to just take a step and ask you, where is God moving in your heart of compassion? Because the time for justice is always now. And I want to leave you, if you're feeling a little overwhelmed at all of this morning, with just an encouraging story about our adoption. that got me involved in all of this to begin with. Because we had an organization called the Starfish Foundation that helped us to adopt, because it's an expensive venture. And the starfish was all, they got the name from the parable of the starfish. And I don't know if you've heard it, but it's a story of this little boy, and actually this man who comes along the ocean, and he sees this little boy, and he's picking things up, and he's throwing them back into the ocean. And what he realizes is this boy's throwing starfish in. When he asks him, the boy says, "Well, I'm throwing them in." The man says, "Why are you throwing them in?" He says, "I'm throwing these starfish in the ocean because if I don't, they're going to die on the beach." And then the man looked around, and he was like, "Well, don't you see? There's hundreds of starfish. You can't possibly make a difference to all these starfish." And then the little boy reaches down, and he picks up a starfish, and he throws it in, and he says, "I made a difference to that one." And this story really hit home to us, because the second time we went to Vietnam to adopt Rowan, we were walking the beach at China Beach, and I had Rowan in my arms, and suddenly we looked down, and we saw a starfish. And I handed Rowan to my wife, and I grabbed the starfish, and I said, "Honey, this is what we just did." And I threw it in there. And then we kept walking down the beach, and I kid you not, there were tens and hundreds of starfish all over the beach. And at that moment, I felt God say, because I felt overwhelmed, I felt him say, "You've got your starfish. You've made a difference to this one who's worth remembering." And I just remember as we were leaving the orphanage, and I still remember it to this day, because I felt these little tugs on the back of my shirt. And I knew what it was, and it happened every time we left the orphanage. It was the little boys and the little girls who were tugging on our shirt because they wanted to go with us. And it killed me to think that I could not bring them home with me. Because I'll tell you, if I had a house big enough, I'd have 143 million kids. Be a lot of grandkids, wouldn't it? But I want to encourage you, because it's just taking a step. It's just one thing. It's just beginning the process. It's beginning by saying, "You know what? I want to land here a little bit. I want to take the time and develop a little bit of compassion permanence. And I want to develop courage to step out when I see something that I know is wrong, and I know I need to do something about it." And it's creative action to be able to work together so that we can right some of these wrongs in our world, because the time for justice is always now. Let's bow in prayer. Father, I thank you, Lord, for this opportunity that I've had to share with this great church. Lord, I've heard of the great things that are happening here at the Orchard, and I love the fact that they're taking this seriously, Lord, your restorative work. God, I pray that you would just bless them, Lord, in every way. Bless them, God, with compassion. Bless them with courage. Bless them with creative action to do something. Help all of us to realize, Lord, that the least of these are worth remembering. And the time for us to act is now. In your name we pray. Amen.